Let me tell you about something new. A new show called G's Power.
G's Power.
Real talk for real saints.
Are you ready?
And it's for real.
Welcome to G's Power Hour live every weekday at 11:30 a.m. on Never Had It So Good Entertainment Network. Your host, G, will bring you informative and entertaining guests and a variety of topics in a way that you can absorb and enjoy. Listen in weekdays and call in at 516-387-1944. We love interaction. All shows can be downloaded if you miss one or found on iTunes the next day. G's Power Hour is powered by Never Had It So Good Sports Media Network.
G's Power Hour.
Yeah.
Well, good morning, brothers and sisters, kings and queens, angels and saints, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks for joining us this beautiful Friday morning. We are in celebration mode this weekend, getting a start with today, which is Juneteenth. And we are going forward from here because we got Father's Day on Sunday. So just, you know, wanting to celebrate the things that matter. And we have with us Professor Julian Chambliss on here with us to talk about not only Juneteenth, but just what's going on in general with our society right now. Good morning. How are you doing? Uh-oh. I guess he's delayed. I know he's a busy man. But, yeah, we're talking about Juneteenth. We also know that the president is scheduled to have a rally on the 20th. We need to recognize also what happened in Tulsa and why there's been a lot of controversy with him having the rally, even though he moved it off of Juneteenth. So normally we would have you call in, but we've had to do some pre-recording this week because of just the way schedules are. We also have later in a half hour Chef Z. Because we've been kind of playing hit and miss with Chef Z and wanted to make sure we brought her back on, and she's going to have some recipes for us. But in the meantime, Professor Chambliss, good afternoon. Good morning, rather. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am doing well. Thank you for joining us and taking the time again. We know that you are busy, and this is a busy time for you, year for you anyway. And I thank you for giving us a few minutes of your time, especially with everything that's going on right now. So can you talk a little bit? I mean, granted, it's Juneteenth, you know, and we try to pay homage to the fact that we were given our freedom, so to speak, or at least, you know, actually, I guess it got finally recognized after about 2.5-3 years or whatever. But what's the saying? Freedom is not free necessarily right now. We're still not free of the discrimination. We're not free of the injustice. We're still not necessarily free. Can you talk a little bit about why this day is so important, number one, Juneteenth, and number two, why all of the protests and everything right now are crucial and are of significance right now, and what you expect to come out of it?
Well, you know, I think of Juneteenth is a crucial holiday for African Americans in terms of recognition of the importance of seizing freedom. As you say, you know, Juneteenth is a holiday that denotes the moment that African Americans were informed in Texas, really 3 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, that they were free, right? So that the slave owners continued to exploit those African Americans until Union officials were able to arrive in Galveston, Texas, and tell people who have been freed. And from that moment, you know, African American lives were fundamentally changed. The tradition of sort of celebrating that holiday, really something that developed in the 19th century as a and we just want to demonstrate citizenship. And you can think about sort of African American tradition on Emancipation Day or Juneteenth, of marching in the streets, making it clear to the world that they were free. And so when I think about the contemporary sort of activism of African American marching in the street, protesting a kind of systemic failure, you know, that is actually a tradition that African Americans had that's been reclaimed, right? That African Americans marching in the street, sort of making a public display of themselves as citizens, refusing to be silent in what they see as their rights as citizens. And that activism is something that I think for contemporary young people, and I do think of this movement as a sort of grassroots activism being championed by a new generation of young activists, galvanized by recognition of the failures of the system. This is an opportunity for them to, I think of their citizenship not as some sort of given, but as like a process that they have to sort of like fundamentally engage in as a sort of like right, that they have to do more than just simply say, why is the system working? They have to get in there as their previous generation did and hold the system accountable to deliver on the fruits of freedom. Not just as an abstraction, but as like a sort of tangible thing that has to be carved out in the public space and made very clear. So, you know, I think about Juneteenth as a sort of conscious effort on the part of Black people to say that they're citizens. And at some level, the protests that we see today are a return to an old tradition for African Americans to be out on the street, challenging a system that's failing, saying no, that we are citizens, and yes, that you have to do the things that you need to do for all citizens. And so that's what it means to me. And I my expectations related to these current protests is that they are going to set a new bar for what we expect in terms of the government. And I don't mean that in some sort of like hyperbole. I think one of the things that's really interesting is the grassroots nature of these protests. The number of people who are really young that are involved in these protests, and the implication of these protests for at the local level, right? At on the ground across the country, you have people sort of organically able to organize and bring hundreds of thousands of people out. And that is something that I feel that that's going to have an impact on people, Black and white people. So it's a real moment, and it's a question. I think, you know, what are going to be some of the manifestations? Because they're going to be different in different places. Because it's a grassroots activism, right? So I'm just looking to see how those people on the ground are going to navigate what they know about their community to try to do more.
I guess, I got so many questions. One, are we going to have to protest and march every several decades or so just to kind of make it clear that Black lives matter? What do you think is going to make it stick, I guess, so to speak? Like you said, I think the grassroots effort is great, but I mean, I just wonder, are we failing? Well, one of the things I think has to happen is that we've got to be more diligent about encouraging African American history being taught in our school systems from the ground up, so that people understand what injustices have occurred and discrimination has occurred, and why things are so much more challenging for African Americans. But what has to make this stick?
Well, you know, I think that it's important to think about these sort of changes as generational changes, right? So there's a way that you can say, yeah, we're all going to have to continue to be mindful of the way the system can fail. And what do people of color have to do to make the system change? I mean, in part, you know, one of the elements of these protests that are really interesting is that there's a lot of emphasis here on not just simply asking for, quote unquote, civil rights, but actually thinking about these protests as like a human rights protest, right? So that the people who are at the core of this are Black women, people, really diverse Black backgrounds, trans people, LGBTQ people. So some of this is not just simply a traditional civil rights conversation, but a conversation around a broader set of human rights that reflects the fact that our society is getting more sophisticated, right? And the intersection of race around these other questions of identity are part of the reason that this is driving it. And, you know, I often think about this in the context of a kind of black political imagination, which has always been one key towards freedom, because Black people are very oppressed in the Western Hemisphere. And so, you know, Black people have always sort of thought about and acted on this idea of being free. When you take into account that fact, it's not surprising that you have Black people out in the street, right? Like, there's slavery, then there's Jim Crow, then there's, you know, sort of like a kind of broader imperialism. You know, you think about Martin Luther King. I think people forget how much people hated Martin Luther King, but Martin Luther King was anti-war. Martin Luther King was about poor people. Martin Luther King talked about equality a lot more broadly, but, you know, Martin Luther King sort of sanctified in white people's minds around what he was a nonviolent protester. But he was a hated man right up until the moment that he died. Like, he was embraced in death. But, you know, you can make the argument that Black people thinking about freedom has been a fundamental element of making America free. And I think that is one of the things that's happening right now. Like, you have a new generation of Black people with a new sense of the way society is constraining them, working very hard to be free. So in that regard, this isn't surprising. What may be, I think, difficult for people to understand and, you know, unpredictable at some level is, where are those new lines around human rights and a sort of freer public sphere, where they're going to be defined, right? We don't necessarily talk about it enough in the context of these protests, but, you know, LGBTQ rights, trans rights, right? Like, you know, these are elements within this conversation. And clearly, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement was started by three Black women, right? So there is real understanding of a kind of systemic oppression represented by like a kind of Black feminist ideology at the heart of all of this. So, you know, I think we have to be true to the process, which we kind of know, which is, we know that people are articulating real critiques of the system and asking for real changes. I mean, and if we can, as a public, understand those critiques and understand those demands, then we understand a roadmap for what's going to happen moving forward.
I want to ask you also about ignorance and how much of an excuse should ignorance be? We've had a few occasions where our commander-in-chief has professed ignorance, not knowing when he's said or done certain things. And it's a little, you know, more than a little bit annoying, offensive, there's other words. When does ignorance stop? And even if you're not necessarily 100% knowledgeable of history, aren't you supposed to be surrounding yourself around people that have some knowledge of the history of certain dates, certain events, certain issues? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there are two questions we always have to ask ourselves when we think about this question. One is this, your ignorance intentional? And the other is this ignorance acted upon? And so I'm going to think about this in the way, when people are acting, and for at some level, for a lot of people right now, this is a really important thing. A lot of white people are at some level right now saying, like, I never quite understood this. And that's a legitimate statement from a lot of people because they've never, they live in a world of privilege, so they've never been required to understand ways systemic oppression works for people who are not white, right? And so they have a lot that they have to take on in terms of getting educated, right? And so one thing that they sort of have to do is be willing to listen, and another thing is, be willing to learn. And those are two different things. Being willing to listen is one thing, and being willing to learn is another thing. And in this context, is the ignorance on the part of someone in power, like a Donald Trump, is that deliberate? Well, when we think about the president, he trafficked in racist language. He defends racist activities or things that I and many other people would argue say is racist, being white nationalist, born here in Charlotte. He refuses to acknowledge the nature of white supremacy, his refusal to change the name or even consider changing the name on a military basis, even though military leaders have said, yeah, we can change these names, right? Like, we don't have to have these names. Those are all deliberate actions on his part. They don't necessarily reflect a kind of ignorance. In fact, they reflect a kind of knowledge that it will inspire his supporters and people who he believes will vote for him to come out and vote because, like, he's defending their right to be racist at some level. And so, he's a special case in the sense that there's a very deliberate process on his part around isolating and demeaning questions of race. And he does it all the time, right? Like, you see how he responds to black female reporters in the press pool versus other reporters. You see how he uses this language of race and this language of racism and white supremacy, so it's like really systematically. So he's not ignorant as much as like he sort of deliberately engaged in a language that reflects a kind of divisiveness on his part around race. Remember, he came to office, he came to prominence championing a lie about the birth of President Obama, right? Mm-hmm. He is a person who's trafficked in racist conspiracies that President Obama is not an American, right? Like, he is not a man who previously was just like going about his business and not concerned with race. His statement during the Central Park Five, his use of violent language around people of color,
there's
nothing about what he's doing now that's out of character, right? Like, it's not fair to say, oh, he's acting ignorantly. He's a 74-year-old man. He's been doing this for decades.
Mm-hmm.
It ain't an accident, right? So you can't. We shouldn't even put him with a white American who hasn't really been confronted with the really systemic nature of racism and is coming to a realization about it in the midst of this moment and trying to understand. Like, that's not who that man is. That man has made decisions about race and racism, and you can go back and see it, and people have gone to great lengths to document it, right? So he's not a man that you should think about as being ignorant of what he's doing. He's a man you should think about being committed to a set of actions.
Wow. So now, where do we go from here? I guess that's my question, is what do we need to do? Should the protests continue? Are they working? Because my concern is that there's going to be a point where the protests become ineffective. I'm concerned about that. So when we don't have the protests, or when they do become ineffective, then where do we go? What do we do?
Yeah, that's a good question. If the protests aren't connected to the ballot box, the protests matter is a question that, you know, I ask myself. And that's the first and fundamental answer. The protests need to be connected to the ballot box. Right? If you think about the impact of protests during other moments in American history, what the protests do and what the protests have done in the past is made people in power aware of the people's demands. Now, in the American context, I think we can always point to how what people are protesting and what they're asking for does not happen. You can always point to that. But there's a way that you can also point to the fact that, like, what the protests do is create a greater political imagination. And I know that seems funky and academic, and people listen to this and like, what's that supposed to mean? But if you can't imagine something better, you're gonna give up hope, right?
Right.
Let's put it that way. Like, if you can't imagine anything better, you're gonna give up hope.
You have to have something
right.
to strive for. You have to have something to move towards, so you have to use your imagination to come up with something better than the status quo.
Right. And so what you see people on the protest doing, you know, like the fund the police, it's complicated for people, but it just simply needs to reallocate resources that you dumped into policing that could have, in fact, been allocated towards care.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think about it, people have cut everything in the last, conservatives have cut everything in the last 50 years and put money into the police. Now police do everything, and the police ain't qualified for that. But the police
right.
don't help mentally ill people. Right, police can't help people who are unemployed. Police aren't designed to help the homeless. The police aren't designed to do very much of anything, and the things that make people commit crimes are policies that allow for people to be uncared for. Right? So if someone's got a mental illness, they become homeless. Someone's got a drug problem, they become a drug addict. Someone, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago, there were many more programs designed to help people. It was one of the consequences of the rise of the urban industrial order. As a historian, I can sort of say that, right? And the reason you got it was because you had a lot of protests and a lot of violence in the streets in the early 20th century, right? Like, you think about protests around workers' rights and rioting and strikes that were really violent, and you got the a kind of, by the time you got to the early 20th century, a series of reforms that were around care. Like, should food be dirty? No. Food and Drug Act. Should children be forced to work? No. They should go to school. Public education, child labor laws. Should people be living in filth? No. Housing laws, right? Like, those were laws because people were angry. Those mm-hmm. were things that happened because people were, like, in the street. Like, there's a reality to that. And even the 1960s, you know, the riots in the late 60s in the summer, you know, we got policies out of that were reacting to them. Like the fair housing law was one of the things that reacted to those riots. We don't necessarily have the same, you know, I worry sometimes that we don't necessarily have the same sort of like political imagination that we had 50 years ago, right? Because people have lost faith in the process. But, you know, part of the reason they've lost faith in the process is because conservatives have really sort of systematically committed themselves to diluting black votes, right? To voter suppression, to defunding institutions that sort of like worked in the affirmative for people. And the politics has sort of played itself into that. I mean, I think Bernie Sanders, in many ways, if you think about his policy stance, the things that he's asked the Democratic Party to do in the last two national election cycles, these are the things, if the country was doing them, we'd all be better off in the sense of these crises that we're in right now. Because make no mistake, the pandemic is the reason people are paying attention to these protests, right? Because the system is failing across the board. So there's no white person walking around right now who doesn't know the system has failed them. And they know this in part because, like, they are living through a government that has failed massively by every measure to help them during a pandemic. And when you compare our government to every other government in the Western world, with every sort of measure, it's done poorly. And you have a president who said, I don't care. And he's the leader of his party. He's not like an aberration, right? Like I always say, like, you know, Donald Trump's not an aberration for when it comes to the Republican Party. He's a consequence of the policy they've always embraced. So more than anything, if you're like marching in the street right now, you need to make a decision about how your vote, how you gonna vote. Like, to me, that's the fundamental, how you gonna vote. If you're gonna be like, well, I don't like Joe Biden because he's like an old white man, okay, that's the choice. But you better be building a political coalition that can defeat that old white man, the Republican Party, and defeat that old white man, the Democratic Party, and that's really hard in the United States of America. You can join the Democratic Party, you know.
I tell people so many different times, okay, you want to get rid of somebody, and that might be the thing to do, but you have to come up with a plan. You have to come up with a game plan, and you have to come up with a person or persons that are going to be the person that's going to take over and do what you need them to do. You can't just get somebody out there and then there's this vacuum, there's this void.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Right.
Goodness gracious. There's so much more I'd like to talk to you about, but I know we've run out of time, but you are invited back at any time. And it's interesting what you said today, because I heard someone say it a few days ago about what the police are and aren't qualified to do, but what they get called for. If it's a mental health thing, they get called. And some of these other things, they get called, and that's not what they're supposed to do, but that's kind of what our, because we lack so many different services, that's where our society kind of gravitates toward in calling the police. So yeah, these other services need to be funded so that we don't have to keep the police in our business all the time. So.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you so
I do think
much.
That, yeah, so true. Yeah.
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 Thank
you.
And like I said, you're welcome back anytime. So. Just let me know because this isn't over.
Okay.
Have a blessed
take
day
care.
Now. You too.
You
take
too.
Care. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we have Chef Z that's going to join us on this Juneteenth. This is G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment, and we will be right back.
Over the past 60 years, Dove Beauty Bar's superior formula has remained unchanged. But when it comes to beauty, everything changed. Together, we redefined beauty. We said no to stereotypes and yes to every type. We let go of judgments and embraced what makes us unique. We're proud to have been there with you, caring for you every step of the way. Here's to the next 60 years.
Welcome back to G's Power Hour on Planet Subject Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. We want to also thank Professor Julian Chambliss for joining us again. We hope to have him back again soon to give us a little more insight. We are continuing to celebrate this weekend, Juneteenth and Father's Day and the beginning of summer coming up. And we have Chef B with us to help us get a handle on some of that. Good afternoon, Chef B. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. Glad to have you back with us. So I don't know where to begin because it's just that time of year where we're just celebrating the dickens out of everything. But we want to make sure we're cooking and eating right. So I wanted to ask you a question before we get to some other things. And that is maybe, what do you do when you're trying to select, let's say, new cooking utensils or pots and pans or what should you look for? That's one of the questions I wanted to ask you.
What do I look for in cooking utensils? Well, if they had paid me to say this, I probably would say more. But I'm kind of, for the home cook, believe it or not, I'm kind of fond of Pampered Chef products.
Oh, okay.
So I just throw it out there. They didn't pay me, so we weren't going to get too much into that. If they want to talk about it and want me to go deeper, holler at me.
All right.
But reason why I like that brand is I look for quality. Like any other thing, you look for quality, craftsmanship. It also helps if they have some type of warranty, responsible sourcing, responsible sourcing where they get their materials. Anytime you use aluminum and it's any type of metal and it has a German origin, then it's going to be really good. It's going to hold up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the main thing. Then price is going to factor in there someplace, but I don't necessarily go for the cheapest of something. I'm still going to go with the brand and what that brand can deliver, because with just about anything else, but more so with pots and pans, you get what you pay for. Oh, my gosh. I have, for instance, my son, he could make his own eggs. So he wanted his own pan. And I figured, you know what? I don't think I want him using mine. So I took him down to Wally World, picked up a cheap two pans I think they weren't even $20. And believe me, they stopped being worth $20 almost 20 minutes into using them. Well, the handle was heavier than the pan, so even to this day, and he can't, I can't throw it away because it's his pan.
Yeah.
So as soon as you put something in it, it all floats towards the handle because the metal that it's made out of is not quality. And so, you know, so it heats unevenly. It had a nice, pretty color, and I'm a stickler about scrubbing the outside of the pots and pans as much as the inside. And what I tell you, I put all my effort into this pan, and I just can't get it to get clean like I like it. So I'm just like, this has a lot to do with the material that it's made with. So that's what I look for. And that's just, you know, you get what you pay for, literally.
Amen to that. I understand that. All right, so let's get down to it. What kind of cooking tips? What do you have for us this week?
Well, you know, Juneteenth is coming up, and so we all have hot and heavy talking about it. And I think that is the day that it's really good to you put the soul food and the barbecue all into one. So you might have some meat out on the grill, and then at the same time you got collard greens on the stove, you know. So I really feel it the way I love the way people celebrate Juneteenth because it's a good way to bring all this food together. And the thing is, I like that Juneteenth represents freedom, and so one of those things is I think about the island of Jamaica. My family, I have a lot of family from Jamaica. And, you know, these are the people, the marooners, and the people who, even though they had their own struggles, they had, you know, they kind of had a history of them being free as well. And so I said, what one way to put a nice twist in my culture is to add some Jamaican spice to my Juneteenth. And so one of those ways I want to do that is with jerk. I love jerk. I'm not a big fan of pork, but that's the one thing that I will eat is when it's jerk. I will eat jerk pork. It's probably not the only time that I eat pork. Yeah, if it's jerk pork, I'm on it. And I think that's like one or two things that I eat that are pork, and then otherwise that's it. But even jerk chicken, I love jerk. I just love jerk. And I thought, you know what, that's a great thing to add to the American celebration of Juneteenth. To me, jerk is like a freedom food because jerk has a history of being, there's two arguments about where jerk originated. And the first argument is that it was from the marooners who settled in Jamaica, the African slaves who had gotten away and settled on the island of Jamaica. That was, they were. The other history says this comes from the Norwalk and the island, the Indians that were already there, the indigenous people that were already on this island. So there's kind of two arguments. I just say they got together and they both enhanced each other's jerk recipes, and that's why we got jerk. But the origin is on the island of Jamaica. You could go anywhere in the Caribbean and get jerk, but you're not going to get it like you're going to have it from Jamaica. And that's the one thing Jamaicans, they're going to pride themselves on. And, you know, the Scotch bonnet pepper, one of the hottest peppers, that is included with jerk. And so if you don't give Jamaicans their due with jerk, you know, you've created a travesty. But I thought, you know, I would love to share that recipe, just a blend of jerk, how you make jerk spices. Jerking, when you jerk meat, it's usually jerk pork or chicken, but we're in the modern, you know, thing, everybody spices are interchangeable. So you can do it with fish, and you can also do veggies. But like I said, there's nothing like jerk chicken. You go to Jamaica, there's little jerk huts all on the sides of the road.
Mm-hmm.
They know that slow roasting. I don't know, have you ever experienced jerk before?
Have you ever had it? Oh yeah, I have. I don't do it as much as I probably should or I would like to. And then I have to be careful because I'm not into spicy food as much as my husband. I have to grow into it. So there's certain things I have to kind of grow into it. But yeah, right. I mean, the times I've had it, I do like it.
Yes, it's a nose opener.
Yes,
it'll open you up. Traditional jerk will definitely open.
Clearing the sinuses, that's where I need to go. Yep.
Oh gosh, you and me both. That's why I sound kind of nasally myself. I might have to eat my own stuff. But even this past few weeks ago, we went out to help a friend celebrate her nuptials, and we went to a popular restaurant in Gainesville for takeout to the Reggae Shack. And of course, I got jerk pork, and whoo, I was a sissy. I couldn't even eat half of it. My nose was running, my eyes were watering, and my husband said, "I can't believe it. You're reacting to this." And I said, "I know, I've become soft. I got to eat this more often because I usually can breeze through an order of jerk." So I was like, okay, I got to toughen up on that. But and they seasoned their food so well, so, you know, it wasn't light. It was there. But
I'm going to have to do that tonight. Because I got some allergy issues going on and some congestion, so I need to do that myself tonight.
I know it's deadly out here, and with this cayenne pepper and ginger, and that's in a jerk spice blend, it's totally good for you. So I might have to, you know, take my own advice on this one because I could definitely use it. But I know that there's a lot of people who like the flavor of jerk, but they just they can't take the heat like you. It's a good flavor, but it's spicy. So on my article this week in the Daily Commercial, I'm actually sharing a spice blend. I shared it the regular way that would produce a mild sauce, mild to medium. But then I also let you know how to make it more of a sweet jerk. That's what I call it. So right when you think it's going to get hot, there's a little sweetness to kind of, you know, ease that off, level that off.
Okay.
The opposite. And people don't realize that when you eat something really spicy and you want to get rid of that heat out of your mouth, you need something sweet. That's why the natural sugar and milk always helps.
Because I do hear that everybody's like, you're not supposed to do water. You're supposed to grab some milk if you've got to get some of that heat down.
Yes, or rum punch.
Okay. That works.
Well, you know, you're eating jerk. You know, you got to kind of stay in the culture.
Okay. I got
I'm there. Yeah, more punch than rum, but you know that combination works.
Really?
But the spice blend is real easy, and the best part about it is I can guarantee you when I read you off the list of ingredients, you have every single one.
Oh, really?
You have every spice. I can put money on it that you have everything already in your cabinet.
Okay, we'll see.
If you knew all the things that it takes. So if you want to see the list written out, you can always go to my Facebook page. After my article appears, then it always goes up on my Facebook page. But the ingredients are tablespoon of garlic powder. Teen, you got that. 3 to 4 teaspoons of cayenne pepper.
Mm-hmm.
2 teaspoons of onion powder. 2 teaspoons of dried thyme, 2 teaspoons of dried parsley, 2 teaspoons of dark brown sugar, 2 teaspoons of salt, 2 teaspoons of paprika, 1 teaspoon of ground allspice, and then you need a half a teaspoon of black pepper, dried red peppers, nutmeg, and then you need a 1/4 teaspoon of ground cinnamon and a teaspoon of ground ginger. You have all those things, am I correct?
I have all of them except I'm out of onion powder. I did not even think to get onion powder. I went Publix had buy one get one on the spices, and I did stock up on some spices recently, but I did not get the onion powder, so I got to do that.
Of course, go get it. Oh man,
okay.
I'm glad I didn't get my money. But see, you have everything. So now, if you want to make this more sweet than spicy, what you would do is you would reduce the peppers in half. Anything, the peppers, the red pepper, the black pepper, and the cayenne pepper, reduce them in half, and then add 2 more teaspoons of the dark brown sugar.
Okay.
And so you still have that same jerk flavor, but less heat. And then all you need to do, all I do is I get out me a glass mason jar, and I just scoop all those ingredients into the jar. As soon as I got them all in there, I just shake it all up. There's my spice. And it usually will keep up to about 3 months inside the jar. It rarely makes it that. When I usually make this amount, I probably have enough. It does a couple pounds of meat, 2 to 3 pounds of meat, or, you know, plenty of vegetables. And so I usually don't have it for long. I usually use the majority of it right away.
Okay.
But it will last
up
to
3 months. I tend to save some of the containers that some of the previous spices have come in, so I could just throw it in one of those containers if it has a sticker on it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can do that. Now, another thing is I like to make the seasoning like what we call a wet seasoning. Now, you don't have the onion powder, so what you could do is you could take a half. Okay. Well, I take usually, and I said a half, I usually take a small yellow onion, a green bell pepper, and fresh ginger, and I put those things in a blender. And once I put all those things in a blender, then I add the spices to that, and I add about, you know, probably about 1/4 cup of olive oil to make my spice, you know, wet, and then I'll marinate with the meat that I'm going to use with that, or even just rub that on the whatever I'm going to cook with that spice. And I usually do that for chicken, or like gamey pork, and I say gamey pork because that's usually like if I go somewhere and I get a cheaper cut, you know, like a butt or something like that. So I usually will use the wet seasoning for that to really get in there and help bring a you know, a nice pleasant flavor to the meat. And especially if I'm using like chicken breast, because they tend to dry out when you're barbecuing them, so this also helps to lock in moisture and things like that when you're barbecuing. Now, another thing is when you're jerking something, you have to go low and slow. You can't treat it like typical barbecue because of the sugar that's in the barbecue. You know, like you ever notice that once you put your barbecue sauce or your meat on the grill, it really starts to burn, and you start to get all the smoke on your grill, and you think you burnt your meat up. It's the sugar. It's caramelizing. And so because jerk spice has sugar in it, you have to cook it slower, and it is gonna, you are going to end up with a darker piece of meat regardless. because of the caramelization process. But you just have to be more patient. That's why a lot of these jerk huts, what they'll do is these people will get up before daybreak and go get their fire pits going because they need those fire pits to rise up and come down and turn that wood into coal, to low burning coal for the rest of the day. And then they put their meat on there so a lot of them are able to cook all throughout the afternoon because they've created some type of coal with their wood and that meat can just be there all day. And we know how things taste when they're slow roasted. They just become wonderful.
So
you can't be in a rush when you're jerking something. Just be patient with it. It's also good when people want to do big pig roast. Jerk is awesome for that, especially if you're going to do like a fire pit where you're going to, you know, bury that pig and down in the ground and roast it like that. Jerk seasoning is perfect for that. It's just the way those seasonings marry into themselves is awesome. And I've made my last batch. I made a friend of my husband's went to Trinidad and she bought me back a whole Trinidad spice kit.
Oh, wow.
And so I know that's exactly what I said. I was like, wow. So she had all of these locally packed spices, locally sourced spices, whole pimento, a whole nutmeg, and so it was just like, it was heaven. My husband said, that little bag really makes you happy, doesn't it? And I said, yes, it's going to make you happy too. You're going to get to enjoy the fruit of my labor and having those fresh spices because they just taste differently when they come from these spice islands. The spices are just awesome. But if, you know, jerk is easy, that particular recipe will be up and it'll be up before Juneteenth, even though I know plenty of us will probably celebrate on
Saturday. Yeah. Okay. So it'll be up today. So that's good. Yeah,
it'll be up today. It'll be all there for us and everything. And this everything just kind of snuck up on me this month, I can tell you. I said something to my husband. I said, you know, on the 18th, and he went, that's Thursday. And I went, what?
It does. Things are flying. Half the year is just about over. So, I'm just trying to take it one day at a time right now so I don't get all frustrated and anxious and everything. Just trying to take it one day at a time. So the one thing I got now is your recipe. So I'm going to take my time with that recipe, and I think I'm going to run out to the meat market and grab some stuff and work with it.
I'm telling you, it's awesome. You're going to be addicted. Don't forget to get yourself.
Yes, ma'am.
We won't say what kind.
Definitely
got
to get the punch.
Yeah, don't forget your punch so you can make it all a complete meal.
So we got, and then, like I said, I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
No, it's okay. You can go ahead. It's okay.
We got summer right around the corner. You know, it's all kind of converging at one time. Juneteenth, Father's Day, summer. It's all kind of converging. So you usually have, and I guess I'm just going to have to go back and pull one of the other shows that you've done. And you have had good summer drinks on, too, before.
I can't believe that. I haven't really I know why I haven't really been into concoctions because my sister-in-law has a friend in New York City who sells, I said rum punch because that's what she makes, a rum punch, and all you have to do is add the rum to it. And she's in New York
City. And so I had an opportunity to be able to support her and her business, you know, during this time. So the rum punch is kind of I'm just digging back to my roots, and everything is just kind of working itself out. So to know that I got jerk, I got rum punch, everything is all, you know, it's working itself out.
Everything's right with the world, huh?
Yes, that is the thing that I've been working on, letting it just work itself out on itself. But that lady, her name is Judith Stiles, who does, if anybody ever wants to go look on Instagram for her, it's really good.
I'll try to pull that up and put that on the G's Power Hour Facebook page. What you got in the way of dessert, though? That's what I want to know.
You must already knew what I was getting at.
Okay.
What I was already doing. Already was into this. You know, cake for, I think this cake is perfect for Juneteenth, but it's also perfect for Father's Day. Because, you know, my husband, he likes cake every now and then, but he doesn't want a girly cake. And even though I didn't know cakes could be male or female, but apparently so. And so I think the more, you know, like if he sees a red velvet cake, he's not really that drawn to it.
That's a girly cake.
A strawberry cake or, you know, stuff like that. But then if I show him, I say, oh, you want a piece of this German chocolate? Now you're talking. That's more meatier, you know. Or if I say, hey, you want some of this caramel cake? Now then it's on. If I give him a caramel cake, it's over. And so for someone who really doesn't do a lot of sweets, I can always get his attention with a caramel cake. So quickly, a Southern caramel cake is real easy. And anybody can just look up their version of this recipe online. They're easy to find, but they're basically the same. It's a cup of butter, which is 2 sticks, 2 cups of sugar, 4 eggs, 3 cups of flour, self-rising, a cup of buttermilk, and 2 teaspoons of vanilla. So what you'll do is you'll preheat your oven to 350, of course. This will make 2 9-inch cake pans. And so just like any cake, you'll cream your butter until it's fluffy. You add your sugar, and then you will add your sugar and your butter together and cream it till it gets nice and creamy. You add your eggs 1 at a time, and then you'll add your flour in 3 increments. Then you will, the increments is between the flour and the buttermilk, beginning and ending with the flour. Add your vanilla, beat well. Then you'll separate that cake batter into 2 different pans. So that's your cake. So then once your cake is going, you would do your caramel icing, which is even easier. So that's 4 cups of sugar because we're making caramel, 2 cups of buttermilk, a cup of Crisco, a cup of butter, and 2 teaspoons of baking soda. This is cake. This is not healthy. So I know y'all all heard buttermilk, Crisco, and sugar.
Yeah.
It's cake. So in a really good pot, hopefully you have a good one, like a Dutch oven, you will mix all your ingredients together, and you will put that on probably a medium heat, and you will actually, all of that will start to meld together, and that buttermilk will start to get a nice caramel color. I recommend, if you have a cooking thermometer, get one. If you don't, get one, because it's very important, because you're making candy on top of this cake. So you want to get this temperature, they're fat, real fat thermometers. They aren't hard to find. You can find them right, in the grocery store, and it's no biggie. You just kind of attach it to the side of your pot. You're good to go. So you'll get that up to what they call the softball stage, and it's about 235, 245 degrees, and your candy thermometer, it'll show you on the thermometer. Once you've got that and your cake is done,
mm-hmm.
you can take the cake. You take the cake out.
Mm-hmm.
You put the first layer down. You pour half of that on top of the first layer. You put
mm-hmm.
your second layer of cake down, and you pour the remaining amount of that caramel. And I pour half of the half that's left and
uh-huh.
let that kind of set a little bit. And
uh-huh.
then once that sets a little bit, then I pour the remaining amount over it. And if your caramel starts to harden up on you, don't
mm-hmm.
turn your stove back on, but just sit your pot on the warm stove. If you have a decent pot, funny that you
mm-hmm.
asked that, everything
mm-hmm.
is relevant. It will keep your
mm-hmm.
stuff hotter longer. But, you know, once the cake cools off, it's delicious.
Uh-huh. Okay. We're going to get that recipe and post that as well, and also through the links to your site. So thank you so much for being with us today. Wish we had more time, but have a blessed weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you all for joining us. This has been G's Power Hour. Never had it so good. Entertainment. Have a blessed day, blessed weekend, and please remember all real power comes from God. Take care.